First day back at work after paternity leave, and Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is jumping right in.
I don't want anyone to use our tools to undermine democracy.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, September the 21st. Good as always to have you along, everybody. In the drip, drip, drip of updates about Russian interference with last year's election. The news a week or so ago that Facebook had sold about $100,000 worth of social and political ads to accounts affiliated with Russian organizations was a biggie. The press has thus been on for the company to reveal what the actual content of those ads was. CEO Mark Zuckerberg took to a Facebook Live this afternoon to make the announcement.
We are actively working with the U.S. government on its ongoing investigations into Russian interference. We've been investigating this for many months now, and for a while we had found no evidence of fake accounts linked to Russia running ads. And when we recently uncovered this activity, we provided that information to the special counsel. We also briefed Congress, and this morning I directed our team to provide the ads we've found to Congress as well.
While Zuckerberg has been busy digging into the company's Russia problem, Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg has another fire she's been dealing with. ProPublica reported, and we had the interview here, that Facebook advertisers could target ads using anti-Semitic keywords. Sandberg has promised to strengthen the company's ad enforcement. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has the update on that.
Want to sell vintage clown collectibles or T-shirts promoting civic responsibility in Des Moines? Facebook and its algorithms can help figure out who exactly might want to buy.
Facebook's market value and really its business relies on its ability to identify very detailed and highly specific information about users.
Kartik Hasanagar is a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania.
Facebook's ad platform is completely self-service, completely automated. You can go in right now, submit an ad, and it takes a few minutes for it to be approved, but even that process is automated.
In order to stop some of the offensive ad targeting, Facebook has promised to tighten standards and add more human oversight. That introduces new issues.
You throw human beings in there, you slow the whole process down.
Nobody wants to wait for their Des Moines T-shirt ad to post. Pivotal analyst Brian Weiser says the ad scandal is one of a series of black eyes for the company. Fake news, the Kremlin-linked election ad Zuckerberg talked about today.
It's been about 10 shoes that have dropped.
He says we've reached a point where Facebook has to do more to be a good corporate citizen, yes, but also to protect its bottom line. Advertisers, in light of the news pile-on, are likely to take a closer look at Facebook. So will government regulators here and abroad.
All these things will play together in a, well, less than positive way.
More angry emojis, fewer likes. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
The acronym of the day this Thursday is EDGAR. It stands for Electronic Data Gathering, Analysis, and Retrieval, a platform created and run by the Securities and Exchange Commission. It could also be known, though, as the latest victim of hacking in this economy. The SEC made the disclosure that it had been breached late last night and added that, oh, by the way, it's possible some insider trading was done as a result. John Stark was an enforcement attorney at the SEC for 15 years. Mr. Stark, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kai, how are you today?
I'm well. Do me a favor, give me the layman's explanation of what EDGAR is, would you, just so we all know what we're talking about?
Sure. That's just a place that the SEC set up, actually pioneered at the time, where companies could make their public filings to the SEC, like annual reports, earnings reports, executive information, other kinds of data.
It also, though, includes some non-public information, yes?
It may. It really depends on the type of information that's flowing.
Okay, so when you see the phrase, as we saw in the SEC statement about this hack, possible illicit trading, what kind of bells and whistles go off in your mind?
Well, first, I was really impressed with the SEC's disclosure in the sense that they actually disclosed the worst case scenario of this information being made public, which is that a ring of insider traders could somehow access that information and then use it to trade ahead of its own release.
And just to be clear, that's a big no-no. You can't do that.
Yeah, the law is pretty clear. You can't trade on material non-public information. You have a duty to either disclose or abstain from trading if you know that kind of information.
Do me a favor and put me inside the mind of an enterprising hacker who knows he can get inside the EDGAR database. What does he or she look for, and then what do they do with that information?
Oh, gee, that's a tough one. You know, it's sort of like when someone comes into your house and wants to rob your house, and you come home and you see your drawers and everything are scattered everywhere, and it's really haphazard. My experience with different hackers and attackers is they sort of rummage through everything and look for anything that they can find. And then they might later on look at that data and maybe sell it to somebody else or maybe use it for something else. As far as insider trading goes, anytime you know information, that the material information that the public doesn't know, you're going to have an advantage in terms of trading. Whether you can actually use that advantage to profit is another story. It's not so easy to conduct insider trading. You know, it also has its own risks. And remember, you leave an audit trail when you do that, so you might get caught.
Right. You brought up something interesting there. It's entirely possible, if not likely, that the hackers were not the traders.
Oh, absolutely. Exactly, Kai. Yeah. In fact, you know, most of the time there's just multiple layers of these kinds of organizations, and they're loosely connected. Huh. And the person that steals it isn't necessarily the person that uses it or exploits it.
Let me get back to the macro picture here then for a second, forgetting the fact that all of our data is already out there. If I am a mom-and-pop investor or even a small but sophisticated investor, what's my interest level in knowing that the Edgar database has been breached?
Well, I think in general, if you trade in the marketplace, you need to have faith that there's integrity in that marketplace. And that's why the SEC is there. That's why there's a whole specialized set of regulations that make sure that everything that goes on in the marketplace is fair and above board. So anytime there's a disturbance or a disruption along those lines, I think you're going to be concerned and you're going to be hesitant. But in the end, I think you'll probably still be confident in the markets and you'll still trade as you normally would.
John Reed Stark was for many years an enforcement attorney, internet enforcement attorney at the SEC. He now runs John Reed Stark Consulting. Mr. Stark, thanks very much for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai. Anytime.
The entire island of Puerto Rico is still without power. Today, local officials say it could take months to restore full service, and it's not going to be easy to do at all. The utility was already $9 billion in debt and in the middle of bankruptcy proceedings, and now there's a huge repair bill and the problem of deciding how you go about rebuilding electrical infrastructure basically from scratch. Marketplace's Aaron Trank has more on that.
Critical infrastructure like hospitals and schools will be top priority for local authorities, but Benigno Aguirre at the University of Delaware's Disaster Research Center says the businesses that drive the island's economy won't be far behind.
They have the possibility of impressing on the governor and others. Here we have this labor force stop or this prime material going to waste. That is also a criteria that they use as they go about restoring power.
Tourism accounts for about 7% of Puerto Rico's economy, and the high season is November through January, when hotels charge top dollar. Mauro Guillen is a professor at the Wharton School.
They wouldn't be surprised if they try to make sure that hotels and all of the tourism-related facilities get prioritized so that they're ready for receiving tourists, because otherwise, you know, jobs would disappear.
But if residential areas don't get the lights back on, residents could disappear too. 400,000 people have left the island since 2008, most seeking economic opportunity on the U.S. mainland. Puerto Rico will rely on federal aid to clean up from Maria, but private investment is what the island really needs right now, says Carl Cates at the Institute for Energy, Economic, and Financial Analysis.
And to attract the kind of capital it needs to turn its economy around, it needs to rethink its electricity grid along the lines of something that's much more in step with the time.
With more reliance on renewable energy sources, especially local solar instead of oil. With the lights off in parts of Puerto Rico for months to come, Kate says the need for an updated energy system will only grow more urgent. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was down because markets do that too, you know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. On the theory that the theatrics of a big political speech matter almost as much as the content, British Prime Minister Theresa May is going to be in Florence, Italy tomorrow, an historic hub of the European economy, to give a speech in which she will lay out her plans to get Brexit negotiations back on track. Things have become fractious in May's cabinet, which becomes a problem when you remember that the details of Britain's departure from the European Union have to be completed in the next 18 months. The clock is a ticking. Londoners especially are worried amid a steady stream of news about other European cities luring international banks away. The German city of Frankfurt seems likely to benefit from any Britannic financial exodus. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports, not everybody in town is overjoyed at the prospects of thousands more bankers showing up.
In a cozy little restaurant on the edge of the financial district, the young owner, Louise Höpfner, makes herself a cup of coffee and relaxes after the lunchtime rush. Louise is rather pleased with herself. She took a gamble opening her restaurant a year ago. Now she believes it'll pay off, thanks to Brexit.
I think for me it will increase the demand, actually. More people, more business, more money. The Brexit will be good for us.
No one knows for sure how many bankers will flee London after Brexit and how many will end up here. 10,000, say the Frankfurt authorities. Some say it could be 50,000. Two blocks away from Louise's restaurant, another local business is quietly gearing up for the influx.
Welcome to our Frankfurt office. I can show you here some interesting properties.
Olivier Peters owns the Sotheby's real estate franchise in this city, selling high-end properties to the very well-heeled.
This is now one of the most expensive properties we are currently offering. It's a beautiful villa for 4.9 million euros.
Cheap. By London standards, the same mansion in the British capital would cost three times as much. But Olivier says Frankfurt prices are rising.
We have sold some villas where we were of the opinion that this may be 10 to 15% overpriced, but we still got them sold quite quickly.
Because of Brexit?
We cannot answer for sure, but it went much quicker than before Brexit.
No sales yet to London-based bankers, but just the prospect of at least 10,000 rich newcomers arriving in the city appears to be pushing up prices. Deutsche Bank, whose twin towers I can see on the skyline, reckons that Frankfurt property overall is up 11% since the Brexit process began. And that's worrying some local residents.
People who live now in Frankfurt, they fear very strong that the prices will go up and up here and they have no chance anymore to live in Frankfurt here.
Festus Meyer, a middle-aged office worker, says there's already an acute housing shortage here. Frankfurters of modest means will be forced out of this city and it'll become more exclusive.
We'll change the atmosphere. It will change here some parts of the city of Frankfurt here. And the gentrification here will start.
Gentrification?
The gentrification, yeah. They don't like it too much, general public here. Yeah.
And here's his vision of hell. This broad avenue in the centre of Frankfurt, Europa Allee, is a likely destination for the incomers. Luxury apartment blocks and shops have been springing up here for more than 5 years. Several hundred people already live here, but it doesn't look or feel like a community. Tobias Schmitz of local housing campaign group MHM.
We don't see many people around here. It's pretty grey and it's sterile. No life at all. It's dead. It's like a ghost town.
He claims the financial workers who live here only use the place to crash at the end of the day. They have no interest in putting down roots.
It's a very fast business. People want to make money in a few years and then move somewhere else.
He'd prefer the Brexit bankers went to Paris instead. But on the other side of town, not far from the European Central Bank, I met two students, Robin Ladvig and Saman Dunaday, would be happy to see the fleeing bankers rolling into town.
With more bankers coming in, there will be higher income of taxes. That will also improve not only Frankfurt, but the whole region.
My comment on all the bankers is come over here, you're welcome.
The more the merrier.
Yeah, the more the merrier, yeah.
But it must be said, those two students are studying finance. In Frankfurt, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
Coming up.
One movie theater owner told me the way he'd get rid of the kids was to show a few travelogues.
Yeah, that'd do it. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 53 points on this Thursday, 0.2%, finished at 22,359. The NASDAQ off 33 points, about 0.5%, 6,422. The S&P 500 down 0.7%, 2,500 on the nose. We talked about Facebook shares down 0.6% today. General Mills has reversed course on its pledge to remove artificial colors and flavoring from its Trix breakfast cereal. Rather than chemical colors and high fructose corn syrup, the company had created a version colored by turmeric, purple carrots, and radishes. But the kid said no. The original goes back on store shelves in October. General Mills shares down 0.9% today. Kellogg off about 1.2%. Bond prices, a little bit flat. Yield on the 10-year T-note, pretty much steady, 2.27%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This just in from the Marketplace desk of Everything Old is New Again. Google, the company that handles your email and your calendar and your file storage and your internet searches, is betting big on hardware again. The company, you might remember, bought and then sold Motorola a couple of years ago. It's now buying a chunk of HTC for just north of $1 billion. Not a straight-up purchase. It's acqui-hiring, as they say, pretty much the entire engineering department of the Taiwanese phone maker. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath explains the play here.
For more than 10 years, Ryan Reith has gotten paid to see deals like this coming. This time...
To be very honest, I heard this rumor come up, I don't know, a week or two ago. I didn't think it would pan out.
Reith is VP of mobile devices at the research firm IDC. He says it's no secret HTC's in trouble, losing money.
They've been rumored to be shopping themselves around for the last couple of years, so I think, you know, this is a lifeline.
And what does Google get from the deal?
So I'm not quite sure, to be honest.
That is the $1.1 billion question. JP Gounder of Forrester Research thinks he knows what problem Google's trying to solve.
Android is the most popular operating system in the world, but Google has a relatively limited role in dealing with the hardware part of that.
And that was by design, Gounder says. Back when Google first bought Android, the idea was to create a free, open-source platform. Anybody could build on it, make their own special version for their own special device. The Silicon Valley utopian dream. Problem is, that dream came true. With a million different versions, none were outstanding. No one phone to rule them all. Someone else made that phone.
When Apple releases a device, they have very strong control over what version of the operating system you're using.
Which lets Apple keep iPhone owners using its own services, from Apple Music to Siri. Gounder says Google will use the 2,000 or so hardware engineers it's buying from HTC to perfect its new Pixel as the ultimate Android phone. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
There's something of a disconnect going on in the American labor market. Yes, the headline unemployment rate is low, 4.4% most recently, and there is a record number of job openings in this economy. But there is still a big pool of potential workers out there. There are more people sitting on the sidelines, not actively looking for work, than there were before the Great Recession. And there are more long-term unemployed and people with part-time jobs who want to be full-time. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what's going on there.
U.S. employers have just over 6 million jobs open right now. Meanwhile, about 8.5 million people are either looking for work or say they want to work but have given up looking.
Why can't we match these workers to these jobs?
Labor economist Aparna Matter at the American Enterprise Institute.
Some of it has to do with skills mismatches. People don't seem to have the right skills to fill those jobs.
And for those who haven't found steady work for a while, this can turn into a vicious cycle, says Kathy Barrera at ZipRecruiter.
Employers don't tend to like to hire people who have been unemployed for a long time. Then they have an even harder time finding work. Then they're unemployed for even longer.
Barrera says employers are also now offering more part-time jobs, often with unreliable and inconsistent schedules. That's been Russell Frost's experience. He's 56, lives in Escondido, California, and has been working low-paid part-time retail jobs for the past few years.
Like 4 to 5 hour shifts a couple times a week. You don't make any money, of course, and you can't do another job because you're always waiting for them to reschedule you.
The millions of men aged 25 to 54 who aren't working or even looking for work is what concerns economist Michael Farron at George Mason University.
Over 50% of them say that they are disabled.
Farron is researching whether disability payments, combined with low wages, might be keeping those men on the sidelines. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
¶¶ This has not been a great summer for Hollywood. Wonder Woman aside, maybe Spider-Man 2. Tickets just haven't been selling the way tickets used to be selling. Bad for the studios, bad for theater owners, too. But the movie theater business has never been an easy one. They've been opening and closing with the economic tides for years. Decades, actually. In Baltimore, Maryland, a lot of the grand old movie houses in that city are now churches or maybe storefronts. Photographer Amy Davis has a new book out with pictures and stories of what happened to the economy of Baltimore's movie theaters. It's called Flickering Treasures. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What is it about these theaters that got to you that made you want to spend however many years it was going in and taking pictures and finding these stories?
The book started with one particular theater, a 1939 Art Deco gem called The Senator. I fell in love with this theater, and when it faced foreclosure, it was the last single-screen theater left in Baltimore City. So I decided to do a documentary project, and I didn't know much about the subject when I started. I had kind of a naive view of theaters and movies because as a photographer, as a visual person, I just enjoyed the thrill of seeing a movie on a big screen. I didn't really appreciate that movie theaters were also a business and that they had actually been opening and closing from the get-go, not just in the more recent years like you think of. And so 9 years later, I have a book.
9 years. We should back up here and because there will be people listening to this program who might not remember that it used to be that you didn't have the multiplexes and the cineplexes. You had a theater in town or several theaters in town, and they all showed only one movie. It was that whole single screen thing.
Exactly. You had downtown theaters, but every neighborhood had its neighborhood movie houses. And the movies changed three times a week, and you might go there three times a week. So I spoke to a lot of people, particularly those who were over 60, and they would spend all day. It was a great babysitter.
Yeah, it's the foreword in this thing is by Barry Levinson, and he says, in fact, the Saturday matinee was an activity in and of itself. It was just a thing you did.
That's right. And sometimes they would use their pea shooters to shoot at the screen. So it was kind of interactive during the cowboy Western movies. One movie theater owner told me the way he'd get rid of the kids was to show a few travelogues, and then they would finally filter out of the theater. But truly, the memories of being there all day, it's a bittersweet experience when you look back at it now since so many of them have closed. But it's something to be celebrated.
There are also stories in this book of socioeconomic change, but also racial change in the city of Baltimore as it relates to these movie theaters and the roles they played.
Race is a very important part of this story. Over the span of a century, that's the movie-going era that we're talking about, all of the theaters were segregated. There were students at a black university, Morgan State, who picketed one particular theater that was near their university, the Northwood. And it became such a pressure point that it forced all of the theater owners to desegregate their theaters. So it was a significant milestone that happened in Baltimore.
I wonder if you're a romantic about these old theaters.
Well, I'm less of a romantic than I was before. I realize now that they are a business and they have to make money to stay afloat. But I think I'm still a romantic because all the people I met who have this passion for movies and movie houses, they all share a certain spark. They share a sense of imagination. So you have to be kind of a romantic. And that's what keeps us going, I think.
Amy Davis, her book about the old movie theaters in Baltimore, Maryland, is called Flickering Treasures. Lots of great pictures in here. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kai. I appreciate it.
This final note on the way out today, Dateline Provo, Utah. Dining services at Brigham Young University announced today it's going to break a 60-year-old tradition at the Mormon school and start serving caffeinated sodas. Coke products only will be served, says the school, thanks to its contract with Coke. Also, hot coffee, tea, and energy drinks, still officially not okay. All right, we are out of here. The Dow off 53 points today, about 0.2%. NASDAQ down 0.33%. S&P 500 off 0.73%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor, for a while still, I guess, John Gordon. I'm Kai Rosdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.